Sportsman.
Hey, North South Connection Podcast Network. Welcome back to another edition of The Year That Was. I am Aaron George. You can reach me at Aaron D. George on Twitter. And today we are delving back into the project that I worked on for the last 3 years, which was watching every single WWF, WWE pay-per-view of all time, ranking them and ranking the years based on 12 categories, and an aggregate, I think I'm using that word right, an aggregate of the 12 categories gave us a ranking of total. And this is our 8th episode, so we are looking at the 28th best WWE pay-per-view year of all time, or the 8th worst of all time, depending on if you're an optimist or a pessimist. Before I get started, if you download the episode, please subscribe to the North South Connection Podcast Network page. Give us a review. Share. Everything that we're putting through on this North South Connection podcast. I'm not an egotist or anything, but I think some of it's pretty good. Like, it's not the best in the world, but I think it's pretty good. And if you could find it in your heart to share it, that'd be really helpful. Just to help us grow so that we can get an audience and so on and so forth. So, the 8th worst pay-per-view year, 28th best of all time, is 2004. And I think we need to start with a little bit of a disclaimer. Obviously, 2004, we're going to be talking about Chris Benoit. And I guess if there are some people that don't want to talk about him or hear about him or anything, and this is not the episode for you, I get it. You know, so you can shut it down, join us the next one. But a little preface about my feelings on Chris Benoit. I think we're going to talk about him, obviously. I'm going to talk about his contributions to the year. But I don't know how much we're going to get into heavy praise on him. Because to be perfectly honest, watching at the time, I was never the biggest Benoit fan to begin with. I liked him, don't get me wrong. And when he won the title, I thought it was cool, you know. But if you've listened to this project or if you know me, you know that I value character work and storylines way more than in-ring. In-ring's great, and I appreciate it. But it's the characters and the storylines that really sink me in, right? And that was probably Benoit's biggest weakness. So that probably explains why I was never super big on him. I'm going to deal with his highs and lows of the year. I'm going to talk about him. I'm going to try to not talk about his awful end. But that's where I'm going with it, okay? So if it's not for you, I get it. I hope you'll join me next time. But if we're going to talk about 2004, we got to talk about Chris Benoit and what he meant for the year. 2004 is a weird year. It came really close. It was only 3 points ahead of 2003, so the one we did last time. And when I say 3 points, that's nothing. Like, the aggregate scores are all based on 35, right? So you either got 1 or 35 for each category. And then you had the star rating matches and stuff, too, that kind of add to it. But so 3 points is really nothing. It could have finished lower. It also could have finished higher. It finished only 2 points behind the number 27 year, which we'll talk about next time. So a couple things go in one direction to the other, and this one could have finished higher or lower. I'm a little surprised it finished as low as it did, because I didn't mind rewatching this year. There are some lows, but we'll get to it. But here it is, 28th best year, 8th worst, 2004. So a couple through lines I was thinking about as I was doing it. Number one, why and when did SmackDown become the bullshit show, and when did Raw become the wrestling show? If you remember the last time, 2003, it was the complete opposite. 2003, SmackDown was on fire, it was super fun to watch, and Raw was just full of nonsense, ridiculous angles, and not great wrestling. And I feel we kind of almost switched that, and I'm curious if that comes when Benoit makes the switch, when he wins the Rumble and makes the switch to kind of go over there. So we'll see, we'll kind of try to track that, how it goes. Another through line, does the elevation work? So do they go all in, or do they go half-ass with the Benoit and Eddie pushes? Eddie Guerrero, I mean. I think that's a really important thing to kind of look at through the year, because if you have one foot in the pool and one foot out, you're not really swimming, right? Another through line, get out of the way, Triple H. Last time I'm sure I lost my mind with Triple H. I'm going to try not to do it this week. In fact, I'm going to try to just kind of skim over it. But his presence looms large over the promotion this year, and it does have some pretty negative effects with very few positives. So, and finally, I think there's a lot of opportunities missed in 04, and I think 04 kind of stalls everything. I don't know if we talked about this. Like, a lot of times when I record these things, I kind of just rant, and I don't listen to them back because, you know, I hate myself. But one of the things with Triple H, which is interesting, the promotion as a whole, is from the time he becomes the number one face in 02, really till present day, they never make another major star. Now, you can argue Cena later, and we will as we get there, but he doesn't break through the same way that Austin, Rock, Hogan. It's not the same. He's not accepted by the audience. And I think this year is kind of really endemic of it. Like, you'll see a couple of guys on the verge of breaking out, and you'll see what kind of running into Triple H does to them. We'll talk about it more, obviously, when we get into 2005, which will be substantially later. But yeah, that'll be an interesting point as we go too. So, the first category out of 35 that I rank, because remember, everything is ranked in 10 categories, and then years get matches for either having 4-star and plus matches or 1-star and minus matches. So, the first category that we're looking at for 2004 is matches, which is just a straight star rating average for the whole year. And I have that at 29th out of 35. And so when you think about it, the average star rating for the year is 2.73, and there's only 7 great matches. So you're looking at less than a great match a month. And when we look even closer at it, we'll see that at least 3 of those are from WrestleMania, and 2 of them are from Backlash. So that's 5 of 7 in just 2 months. So the year really ends up getting thinned out, and that's kind of a tricky thing when there's as good of a roster as they have, right? You'd think there'd be more of great matches, considering who was on top for the better part of the year. But we'll see as we go on, they don't match the best worker. They don't seem to match the best workers up with other great workers. They match them up with kind of strange matchups that don't necessarily benefit them. And out of there's 108 matches on pay-per-view in 2004. 44 of them are good. Okay, that's a really not great batting average for a television show, right? It has the largest number of 2-star matches of any year and the largest number of 1-star matches. And so when you're looking at the total, like, there's 44 matches that are good. There's 58% of the matches are either middling or bad. So those are the kind of numbers that are almost kind of excusable. Now, if you imagine a television show where almost 60% of the things on the show were either tepid or outright awful and only 6% were great, that show would be canceled instantly. Like, without even thinking about it, right? That's why a show like Seinfeld, as soon as they felt it was dipping, they got out, right? They got out, they made their money, they were gone. That's why shows get canceled all the time. I mean, even great shows get canceled when there's nothing but... That's the thing with wrestling, right? Like, it's like it should have been canceled because it was so bad for so long, right? It should have gone the way of the show that used to be amazing, and then it's not great anymore. Like, it's almost The Simpsons. That's actually a really good comparison that I never thought about before. Wrestling is very much like The Simpsons. Like, I haven't watched The Simpsons. I haven't watched a lot of wrestling, too. But I haven't watched The Simpsons since, like, the year 2000. But then when I do catch an episode now and then, it's like a shell of its former self, which is kind of what wrestling is, too. And it's funny because Simpsons started in 89. I started this project in 85. I know wrestling's been going on longer than that. But, I mean, mainstream wrestling, you're looking at early 80s, I think, is the beginning point. So it's kind of crazy that the output that we tolerate, that the output is so often less than even good. Never mind great, less than even good, and we still watch and we still support. Those are the benefits of a monopoly, because we're all addicted to wrestling, right? And look, if you're one of these people that, like, loves when the WWE crushes the competition, understand that this is the result. Vince McMahon will often label himself as a creative genius, right? But he is never creative unless he absolutely has to. And now we're in a world where he doesn't have to spend 1 ounce of creativity on wrestling. And years like this really shine a spotlight on it. I think the matches aren't helped too. The guys like Kurt Angle spend a lot of their year on the shelf. And while the JBL character is interesting, which we'll get to later, the matches he delivers as the standard bearer of SmackDown are just not up to par. Compare with the year before. The year before, it was all Angle and Brock Lesnar. This year starts with Guerrero, and you're like, oh, it's going to be really good. But then as soon as we go to JBL, he's fighting Undertaker. He's fighting Booker T. You know, it's just not – you're not going to get the top-level matches. And yes, we get really you get a lot of really good matches with like Orton and Benoit from SummerSlam, Jericho and Christian from Mania. But then we also have to sit through Coachman wrestling. And I don't know why – I don't know what their obsession was with making Jonathan Coachman wrestle. It makes no sense. I feel like he was forced to wrestle. Like maybe they had a gun to his head. Like, look, we need you to be the next big superstar, and you're gonna get it. He was not a Shane McMahon type of guy who took to wrestling. It's a colossal race of time, and he's in the ring with Tajiri, who's basically a wrestling god, the only wrestling god in the company at this point. And Tajiri can't even carry him to something serviceable. And I think Coach's a really interesting on-screen character. No, and you know what? I'm going to take that back. He's not interesting. He could be, but he's not. Nicest guy from wrestling I ever met, though. Do you remember also that Daniel Pruder fought Mike Mizanin in a Dixie Dog match? You understand there's nothing in that sense that makes sense? Daniel Pruder should not be on pay-per-view. Mike Mizanin, I don't want to ever hear that name again. And what in God's name is a Dixie Dog match? I watched this recently, and I don't remember it, all right? And then you got also Dawn Marie fighting in matches. They're redoing Jacqueline and Chavo from WCW. It's like the year has no chance to be good in terms of matches. And with the talent that's on board, it's crazy. The worst match of the year, for me anyway, remember, all of these things are subjective to me, right? I don't fashion myself the only authority on this. The only authority I have at all is that I actually watch them all, right? But your mileage may vary, but for me, the worst match of the year is from Bad Blood. Triple H versus Shawn Michaels, Hell in a Cell. And when I say 47, it's 47 minutes of ring time, right? That doesn't even factor video packages, intros, outros. So honestly, you're looking at, I don't know what, like, over an hour of this pay-per-view dedicated to Triple H and Shawn Michaels. The feud is already past its prime. And now we're doing a completely self-indulgent 47 minutes of a Hell in a Cell, right? And there's just so much laying around, right? You'd think it was fucking Jonestown in that match by the amount of laying around that's being done. They always talk about Paul Heyman dishing out the Kool-Aid, but like this match is basically dishing out the Kool-Aid to your audience. Because I don't want... I mean, I don't know how many times I fell asleep during this match watching it. Because by now the feud's done. We don't need to see these guys fight anymore. They had a really great match at SummerSlam 02. I thought they had a really fun match on Raw to end 03. And as we'll talk about, they're good in the triple threats together, but they're not really the story of the match. We don't need any more of this story. It's just not necessary. They both have better chemistry with other people, right? And this is a great example of Triple H losing the title, but still occupying the top spot on the show. Right? So it's like, don't forget who the real main eventers are here, right? We have Chris Benoit fighting Kane in the undercard in a nowhere near 47 minutes. But here are the real main eventers. Real main eventers, 47 minutes on TV, right? And this is a great example of how you can lose the match, but you don't really get over, right? Like Triple H put over Benoit. He put him over. Michaels put him over the next month. But who's in the main event now? Who's taking up all the time on Raw? Now, this is a consequence, I think, to Benoit not being a great character, too. But this is not the only time this has happened, right? This is how people do not get over, okay? I have it as the 56th worst match of all time. You know, I don't know what that means to you, but I know I had it very close to the Survivor Series 99 match with Fabulous Moolah in it. So this one is, like, bad because it's just so long. There's something technically bad in it. It's just, man, like, pull it back a little bit. Top 5 wrestling matches. From WrestleMania, number 5, The Rock and Sock Connection versus Evolution. Handicap match, I think it's just really fun. It's like the last hurrah for Rock at WrestleMania. He comes back to save Foley on Raw. You got some really interesting matchups in it. You get Flair and Rock kind of like doing their thing opposite each other. Batista comes in for the big spots. And they make the right call. And Orton gets the pin to win the match, which I think is a really great call. So, not hard to see why that's there. Number 4, Eddie Guerrero defending the WWE Championship against Kurt Angle at WrestleMania. I mean, look, this is kind of a dream match. These two are really, they work really well together. I like the cleverness of the finish with the boot coming off. Just a really good, really solid, fun match. Number three, the rematch from WrestleMania, the triple threat from Backlash, which is Chris Benoit defending against Shawn Michaels and Triple H. Obviously, Canada hates Shawn Michaels. I don't know why. The screw job was many years before. Why were they more forgiving of Earl Hebner than they were of Shawn Michaels? Shawn Michaels had much less to lose. He could have stayed atop the promotion. Fuck it, Shawn Michaels is a dick. All right, why'd he do that to Bret? Why'd he side with that and do that to Bret and be friends with Triple H? And why'd he bring in Triple H and make him part of the company, make him part of his group? And now Triple H runs the company because of Shawn Michaels. Fuck Shawn Michaels. Anyway, the match in Edmonton's good. The second best match of the year, Randy Orton defending the Intercontinental Championship against Cactus Jack from Backlash. Awesome hardcore match. And what's really cool about this one is in all these hardcore matches, we see Mick Foley take the brunt of everything. He's the one who goes in the tax. He does this, he does that. Here, it's like trial by fire for Orton. Like, Randy Christ is taking a beating in the match consistently throughout. I will say that on rewatch, I was a little bit disappointed by it. I have it at 4.5 stars. I wanted it to be higher. But that being said, it's still really great. Awesome coming out party for Orton. It's no surprise that by the midpoint of the year, they're giving Orton the title. Because, again, you have to bring out... It's funny, eh? You have someone who's really great at making guys, and you have someone who's really great at destroying guys. And we'll see how that plays out as the year goes on. And the number one match of the year from WrestleMania, Triple H defending the World Heavyweight Championship against Shawn Michaels and Chris Benoit in a triple threat. I think this is probably the best triple threat they've ever done, or at the very least very close. That's probably the best. I have it at 5 stars. I have it as the 35th best match of all time. I can't imagine what it was like. I can't imagine if you were really an intense Benoit fan, how much this match must have meant to you. But that being said, I think it still holds up. There's a spot midway where, like, it looks like Benoit is going to make Triple H tap out to the sharpshooter. Michaels comes in with a super kick. It's great. And Triple H finally tapping out is really good. It's really good. You'd think he was turning a new leaf. He's not, but you'd think he was. A couple of honorable mention matches that don't make the top five. At number six, I have Brock and Eddie. I like the match a lot. I think it suffers a little bit from believability. I don't view Eddie as being able to hang with Brock for 30 minutes. Number seven, Kurt Angle and Guerrero from SummerSlam, which I think holds up really well. I have that at 4 as well. So, 7 great matches, top 5. I mean, I put the top 5 against any top 5. It's a strong year in terms of top 5. Let's talk characters. As characters, I have it 29th out of 35. And let's deal with the elephant in the room, okay? Obviously, this is a very big year for a mentally challenged character called Eugene. Number one, this would not fly today. And quite frankly, I'm surprised that no one has canceled them for it. Because when you look back, it's not really flattering. Like I think it's because no one knows about it. Like, no one cared about wrestling during this point. It was on the decline. So that's why no one's going back. People care about Jimmy Fallon, which is why they're like, oh my God, he did blackface once? We're going to go back and find it. Right or wrong, they're going to go back and find it. Here, they don't seem to care that, like, Nick Dinsmore, who I think did his best with what he was given, is portraying a mentally challenged guy pretty stereotypically. Like, but the thing is, stereotypically portraying a person with a mental disability is, like, really far down on the list of, like, awful things the WWE has done before. So, you know, really, like, if you're going to start with that, you probably need to go back and get rid of X-Pac doing that Nation skit, calling himself Mizark, Vince McMahon calling John Cena the N-word on television, on pay-per-view, no less, in front of Booker T. You know, Triple H fucking a corpse. There's a lot. There's a lot you could go back and say, hey, maybe they should have pulled the plug on this. Here's the thing with Eugene, though. He was over, okay? I'm not going to joke about him, all right? There's no point, right? He is what he is. But I just want to point one thing out, okay? Who is the mentally challenged guy's favorite wrestler? Yep, it's Triple H, you know? It's nice to see them finally being honest about what Triple H's position is on the show. The one guy who, in company history, I mean, maybe the one guy in history who Triple H is his favorite wrestler, is the mentally challenged wrestler. So, you know, you get that. Good characters. You got a couple of good ones. You got Spike Dudley being the boss, bossing around his brothers. That's pretty fun. I think the development of Randy Orton Batista is really well done for the most part in this year. It was done so well that they had a torn Orton. They turned Orton face. Now, that was a giant mistake, and he was a terrible face character. But Batista, on the other hand, developed really well as the cool guy who doesn't need to talk much. Randy Orton, Legend Killer, was a really great character, though. He had that down, and he was starting to deliver in the ring, which worked really well. Edge, I'd also like to bring up Edge. Someone I don't usually like too much, but what I did love about his character this year, I didn't love the facials. I didn't love the in the corner with the spear. I didn't like the convulsions. I don't like his face in general. I find that his jaw is large, and it's fine. I have a weird jaw, too. It's just a preference. I'm not shitting on him because of his jaw. I just think he does have a jaw. And jaw, it's not a usual jaw. It's an unusual jaw. And unusual isn't bad. Just like something can be abnormal and still be natural, right? It's just strange. Anyway, what I love about his character is I love that he's obsessed with winning the title. And I'm sure I've talked about this before, but wrestling or any drama really works best when characters have objectives. And so this character has an objective. He wants to win the title. Great, I can get on board. Everyone should want to win the title. Here's the problem with building Raw around Chris Benoit, is he's just not a great character. I mean, who is he really besides the toothless guy who he can barely put a couple words together? And it's like, he really struggles with the promo to be natural. I never understood, and I still don't understand, why they don't bring in theater coaches to coach these guys. Because I'm sure they bring in film coaches, but that's not the performance they're actually doing. Actually, I don't even know if they bring in acting coaches. They should bring in acting coaches in general. But what they actually are is theater. They're film theater, right? So I don't understand how a guy who's been in the business this long isn't better at like just putting words together in a believable fashion. Like, or just say, or book around it then, you know? I guess I understand why they went with him. I don't think I would have, as the guy to build the Raw. I keep saying the promotion, but it's Raw they're building. Raw and SmackDown are almost two separate promotions. I wouldn't have, but I can also see why they waited so long. Why even a year before he's super over, but, you know, he can't talk. And if you can't talk, it's really hard for them to build a storyline around you. He might be the worst talker of any world champion. I'm saying that kind of not thinking about it. But I'm struggling to think of who could be worse. Even a guy like Yokozuna who didn't speak English said Banzai with more with more conviction. He said Samoa into the camera with more conviction, even though he's from Japan. He said Samoa into the camera with more conviction than Chris Benoit has ever said that he's for real. It's like he can't even emphasize the words right. Maybe that's – and I'm not saying this – that also might be a consequence of the concussions. Maybe I'm stretching. I don't know. We got to talk about Kane, too. I mean, what's happening? Okay? Why is he in love with Lita? Right? I understand if it's 06 Lita, but come on. How many loves – is Kane's got to be the guy who's had the most love stories on the show. Lita, he had – what's her name? Tori. He's in love with X-Pac, and that didn't work out. His father had sex with Undertaker's mother. Everything is this – Katie Vick, he had a long-lost love that he killed and then maybe slept with after she was dead. He's the guy who's had the most love stories in the history of the company, I think. Yes, he's been around a lot, but why do we keep going to the well with love stories with Kane? We don't want to picture him having sex. He's burned. He's all burned up. Okay? We already, as wrestling fans, like, we're not picturing the men having sex. I mean, we're already on the verge, right? Because they're rolling around in little Speedos and stuff. But now we got to picture the burnt guy. Now, if you're burnt and you're out there, I'm sorry. I'm sure you're fine. I don't want to picture you having sex. I'm sure you don't want to picture me having sex. And it's fine. All right? But his penis is probably burnt. Right? It's probably all burnt up. And now he's impregnating someone with it? And she's having a miscarriage? And she grew to love him? Kane would be canceled. You can't stalk someone like the way he stalked her. Force her to marry him. How has no one brought this up when he was running for mayor? So Mordecai, who I believe is an albino, and that's his entire character. Is he a religious albino? I don't know. I don't know if Jesus said anything about the albinos and their position in society. But that's who he is. That's all they gave us. And Heidenreich, who I'm assuming is a Nazi poet. Again, I didn't realize that there were a lot of them, but whatever, you know, you are what you are. Maybe it doesn't work in wrestling. WrestleMania, when JT and I did the rankings on No Holds Barred, check it out in the archives, we had this 5th out of 35. I think it's top 5, it's good, you know. I think this would be an interesting one to see where it would stand if Benoit and Eddie were still alive. Does it finish higher if we aren't saddened by the final shot of them standing in the ring together? Let's talk about the couple things that hurt it, okay? I think the return of The Undertaker was cool. The match with Kane left a little to be desired, right? And sadly, this is only the second of 3 extended Undertaker-Kane feuds. The good news, not the worst. But if all the feuds keep going back to, why do we keep going back to Undertaker and Kane? Could we not just settle this that, like, Undertaker burned... Hold on. So Kane was burned, right, in the basement. I know I'm focusing a lot on Kane and his burnt penis, but he was burned in the basement, right? And he came back with vengeance towards The Undertaker, with Paul Bearer, the father, who had sex with Undertaker's mother. It was an affair, I guess. I'm curious if Roger Undertaker, whatever the hell his name is, knew about the affair with Martha Undertaker. I'm going to assume it's Martha, because all the super-powered people, their parents are named Martha, and that gets them to stop fighting. So Kane is Bearer's son. He's in a fire. But then Undertaker set the fire, right? So, like, everything Kane does up to this point is justified, right? Kane is an attempted murder. An attempted murder. And Undertaker lit him on fire, then they team up. It's too hard to keep track of. There's a novel. Check out the novel. It is what it is. I thought this feud was really good the first time. I don't know why we keep going back to it. We bought it. We bought it that Kane was all burned up and Undertaker lost his parents. We bought it that Paul Bearer had an affair with his mother. We bought that Undertaker was the one who relit the fire. We bought all of it. That's one feud in 1 year. It's a lot. It's a lot to do in 1 year, what they did. But now we're going back. Like, now Taker's a biker. Kane is potentially a necrophiliac. Like, everything's changed. It shouldn't be fighting anymore. People change. Allegiances change. Your hatred fades away. I think once you admit that you've had sex with a dead body, maybe you start forgiving other people too. Like, I don't want to stand in judgment, but I don't know why Undertaker's still mad at Kane. Kane, you did it. You did that to him. In the time, you fought a living train, okay? Let's move on, okay? You don't go back to fighting your brother after fighting a living train. The tag scene at Mania, it was just 8 teams thrown together into 2 fatal 4 ways. They're not bad, but, you know, they're just an afterthought. Sable and Tori fight Stacy and Jackie. It could have been a lot worse. I think the big stinker of WrestleMania, though, is Brock and Goldberg. I get it's completely fascinating to watch. And I get that there were circumstances. But, man, they didn't help each other out by having the slow-ass match they decided to wrestle. It's cool as an experiment, but it's awful, right? And if any match ever needed an audible called on it, it's this one. Austin should have just stung them both, and good night, they're out of here. Everyone ends up being happy. And, I mean, thankfully, this guy's got another run in 2017. And it's really good, but this is all-time bad. Now let's talk about the great stuff, or the good-to-great stuff. Victoria and Molly, I like the women's division when it's built around Victoria. And they have a good match in Mania, and the stip is good with the hair shaving. It's different when it's a woman getting their head shaved. I don't want to sound like a sexist, but, you know, feels like women care more about their hair. I haven't combed my hair in many years. The opener is really fun too, and it's kind of the perfect way to start the show off. If you're not going to go with like a fast-paced, like lighter match, either a tag match or a cruiserweight match, the ascension of one of your hottest acts in Cena is really, you can't really go wrong. Cruiserweight open is great. It involves Ultimo Dragon ruining himself on pay-per-view, so there's that. Probably Chavo Guerrero's best pay-per-view match. I know I'm not as high on Christian and Chris Jericho, their feud, but I thought this match was really good, and you get evil Trish. Eddie and Angle have a great one we talked about. I love the work, the originality, the finish. Rock and Sock was a blast, and the main event's an all-timer. So I think it's easy to see where it has 3 great matches. The bad stuff's not too bad. You know, like even The Undertaker and Kane. I mean, I think I went... I'm just going to check while I do it. I mean, Sable and Tori, I went 2.5 stars. You know, and I don't know, that might sound insane, but it's probably just because I think it was there. Goldberg and Lesnar, I have it 1, but it's just because it's just a colossal clusterfuck. And the Fatal 4-Way is 2.5. I don't even know where I have the Undertaker 1. It's great, great radio where I'm struggling to find... I'm struggling to find things on a spreadsheet. I mean, it must be fascinating. I have it at 2.5. There we go. It's all 2.5. So even then, it's not too bad. Okay. World title storyline is the next category. I have it at 27th out of 35. And we start the year with the continuation of the interminable Michaels feud. So we talked about the match on Raw, and it sets up the Rumble match, right? But then Benoit gets the big gold belt at Mania, and then they obviously stick the belt that main event at WrestleMania into the mid-card. And then it's defended against Kane. It's like the standard small guy who wins at Mania push. It's exactly what they do to Bryan in 2014. Triple H goes back to the main event, and a championship match happens on the undercard. At this point, the world champion is so over, they put him in the tag division as well. And I don't think it's a question if we want to see more of him. Triple H gets to do the real main events. This is how you put someone over, but don't really put them over. Benoit won their matches, but is ultimately in a lesser spot in the card afterwards. And I would argue he might actually be in a lesser spot than before. Okay, the Orton victory midway through the year, it is really cool. I love that they're putting the title on someone new. I love they're taking a risk with Orton. Maybe it was spiteful because they wanted to make a new youngest champion. Whatever. But they undo it all the next night on Raw. And if ever there was a time for Triple H to be vulnerable and be the old guy in the group getting kicked out, this is it. Instead, Orton, who was super over before, gets destroyed for the rest of the year. Triple H gets the belt back a month later. It's business as usual. So the only guy over enough after this is Michaels, who goes back at Taboo Tuesday. And you can see it. That's who gets voted in by the fans. Again, I'm not trying to rag on Triple H, but everyone who fights him during this period comes out worse. Orton wins his next world title in 2007. It takes him 3 years to recover. He has a good 05. 06 is actually pretty good for him too. But this is how long it takes to get back here after this loss. Yes, it's how they book him as a face too, for sure. And I don't necessarily fault only Triple H here, because obviously it was the company's decision to make this happen. But it was a horrible decision. If you want the guy to be successful, run with him. Your ratings are already going down anyway. On the SmackDown side, it starts with Brock Lesnar defending against Bob Holly, of all people, before losing it to Eddie Guerrero. And I like Eddie Guerrero as a champion, but ultimately the belt ends up on JBL, and it kind of dies a slow death the rest of the year. And JBL's grown into the role, which is good, but he probably shouldn't have been carrying SmackDown as soon as he turned. Instead of the year before, where SmackDown's title scene is amazing, it's the highlight of every show, it becomes the lowlights with matches against The Undertaker and Booker T, and only towards the end of the year, when they start to be multi-man matches, they start to get better. And, you know, I get that you want to have cowardly heel as champion too, but it's hard to buy a cowardly heel who's bigger than most people. Mid-card story, I have 16 out of 25. And thankfully, with a terrible champion on top of SmackDown, they more than make up with it by kind of building the mid-card around the hottest guy in the company in the U.S. title scene. And I know it's easy to think of John Cena as the guy who gets booed by the people everywhere, but in 2004, he is over, right? He's kind of the last guy they pushed up the kind of ladder system. You know, where it's like, okay, you come in, you win some matches, you win a secondary title, you win the Rumble or runner-up, and then we push you up to the main title, right? He's kind of the last guy they do that with. Everybody else, they just kind of jump up. Roman Reigns is a great example. It's also a rare time when they put focus on the undercard on SmackDown, because normally these mid-card titles, they just kind of vanish. So it's nice to see when their top guy is carrying it, at the very least it has some prestige. Even though they put guys, Cena fights, the guys he fights are less than stellar, right? Rene Dupree comes to mind in his stupid French tickler dance. Cena still does really well with it and maintains his overness, which is great. You know, I really appreciate John Cena in this year. On the other show, things are pretty decent too. You got the Shelton Ascension, which is pretty well done. And it's kind of a shame they couldn't do the same thing with Haas. Before Shelton, though, I really like Orton running the Intercontinental Division. It's good star power. It kind of fizzled after he lost the belt to Edge, even though Edge has that really cool focus. Jericho and Christian have kind of an underwhelming ladder match at Unforgiven. You know, it's clearly not the focus of anything once Orton moves up to the main card. And the only thing I would other say about mid-card is the ascension of Eugene that we talked about as an interesting character. Again, I never liked the character. I didn't find it offensive or anything at the time. Maybe I do know. I don't want to speculate on that. But it was an over character who ran straight into Triple H. And you know, as soon as it was done, he's doing musical chairs on Raw, which I love that segment. I actually really love that segment, especially Ric Flair in that segment. But he's never taken seriously again. So much so that the next year when Angle destroys him, it's fine. You know, he's more than dead by that point, right? And, I mean, they just made him out to be an idiot. Like, Triple H is jumping in the bouncy castle with him. And they, I mean, I get he's mentally challenged, but, like, what are you doing? What are you doing here? Why does Triple H have to beat him? Tag team storylines, I have it 34 to 35. Fuck this division, all right? Do you know, do you like the Japanese fella and the albino teaming up? What about Haas and Rico? Or Billy Gunn and Hardcore Holly? Did you want to see two-thirds of the hardcore match from WrestleMania 15 team up and help destroy a division? What about a watered-down version of Too Cool? You know, because the other guy's over in TNA making my life a living hell on TNA Never Dies, which is our other show in the North-South Connection podcast network. But all of these teams are just two guys thrown together over on Raw. It's the French guys, the one team. French guys defending against Flair and Eugene or Tajiri and Rhino. Why is the only consistent team have to be the worst possible representatives of the province of Quebec? They were booed in Montreal when they came to Montreal. Dino Bravo was treated like a goddamn king in Montreal. And these two get sodomized with a flag by Batista, and the entire city of Montreal is a fucking festival. Women's storyline, 20 out of 29. Remember, not every year has a women's... any women's stuff, right? So that's why it's 29. I think the division peaks with Victoria and Molly fighting. And really, as long as Victoria's on the Raw division, it's watchable. Gail Kim's an interesting addition. She doesn't really contribute too much. Jacqueline fights Chavo. I don't know if that fits into women's storylines. I don't know if it helps women's rights. All I know is I don't want to see Chavo anymore. Sable, years past her prime, is running the SmackDown women's division with Tori Wilson. And here's another big problem. Jackie Gayda. So this is the top wrestling promotion in the world. And they put Jackie Gayda in the ring and on TV. It's like you go see Schindler's List, right? And like, Ralph Fiennes is awesome. Liam Neeson is awesome. The girl in the fucking red dress is awesome. But then they cut to some guy they pulled off the street saying like, "Oh, Mr. Schindler, can I get on your list?" Why does the number one company in the world put people on TV that are not good? It should be the best people only. I'm all for giving people chances to succeed, but she was on TV a lot, and she's in a lot of matches, okay? And it's not like she was even having sex with someone that was important, right? How did this happen? Royal Rumble, 18th out of 33. And I know this might feel like blasphemy being in the bottom half for Rumbles, but hear me out. I think it was cool Benoit run at the time. I think it really suffers by him being so subdued during the last half of the match. Okay? And to the point where in the match, he's not really doing anything. The announcers don't help this one either. They don't tell the story of Benoit going the distance and, oh my God, he's still in there. Contrast it with the best example of that is Bobby Heenan cheering for Ric Flair. He's telling the story consistently that Flair's been over there forever, right? Monsoon even comes in and says, well, you got to give it credit because he's been in there for forever. They don't do this at all for Benoit, and I think it hurts the match because the narrative is so kind of all over the place. Now, emotionally at the time, it kind of popped me big because it was cool they were doing something new. But on rewatch, it felt like there were Rumbles that were had much better structures and much better moments. Now, you do have the interesting thing of Benoit eliminating all the big guys. I think that's a cool touch to kind of show that he can hang. But I'll be honest, rewatching it, I do have trouble. He's choking everybody out to put them out. He chokes Big Show out. I think he chokes somebody else out. It's, I don't know. Like that's where, to me, I don't usually struggle with his matches. But when I see the choke, when I see the cross face, I'm like a little, like, it's a shame, you know? And it's kind of a shame. Like it or not, that's his legacy now. His legacy is he is the person who did these horrible things. You can make the argument he was a human being before and he has a whole career. And it's true, right? It's true. But in the end, you're defined by kind of the biggest thing about you, right? Andre the Giant's legacy is that he was a over-the-top wrestler, right? It wasn't that he was a big drinker, even though he was. People talk about it. It's not that he was a good man. It's that he was a wrestler. Wayne Gretzky's legacy is going to be that he was the greatest goal scorer ever, unless Ovechkin passes him. But So you're always defined by that biggest thing, right? JFK's legacy is that he was assassinated, which is insane because he basically saved the world, the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? Like it or not, this is his legacy. And you can try to defend it and say he was a good person before. Maybe he was. But those last moments of his life unfortunately stripped that away in terms of legacy. Orton killed it in the Rumble, though. I thought he was the best part of the Rumble. He had a great brawl with Foley. It was electric. It really pushed everything forward. I was really happy that also that Foley took the place of Test in the match. I don't know why Test is still a thing in 05. I don't know why he's a thing. I think it's 07 he comes back. The Test failed a long time ago. All right? You name a guy Test, you get a couple chances. You don't bring him back for nearly a decade. I will say too, that for, till this day, I will die supporting the Cat and Lamar dancing around the ring. It's so amazing. I wish that he would come into the ring now and dance. And I today it'd probably be punctuated with Michael Cole screaming about how entertaining it is. So maybe it's safer he's at home. Historical importance. When JT and I did it on No Holds Barred, we had it 19th of 35. It's not a huge important year. I mean, you get the push of the small guys, but it kind of gets undone the next year. Next year, they're back to pushing the bigger guys, right? So if there had been a trend where, okay, now we're pushing small guys, you know, maybe. I guess you can say Rey Mysterio in 06, but it's really a consequence of Eddie. So it kind of strips away that. I think the big important things are Orton, Orton's crowning, Orton and Foley having their stuff. I think the WrestleMania, it's the last WrestleMania at the Garden, which I think means something too in terms of importance. The ascension of Cena, the ascension of Batista, although the next year, 05, is obviously more important for that. This is where it all begins. So it's not a year where a ton of stuff happens, but it's also not a year that really hurts the business too much. It's kind of just an in-between year. SummerSlam, or the SummerSlam, as we say in Canada. I have 19th out of 33. And were you aware it's Bizarro Land? Or, more appropriately, if you don't cheer for who we tell you to cheer, you're in the wrong land? Maybe that's why they don't come to Canada anymore. It's like, people are allowed to hate Eugene, right? Like I said, I didn't think it was a good character, right? So you're allowed to think it's a bad character. I think you're allowed to think it's insulting. He's a bad character. You're allowed to boo him. The main event with Orton and hitting Benoit of nowhere with the RKO for the world title, I thought was really great because it really did come out of nowhere before out of nowhere was a thing. And it's kind of a forgotten solid match. I know it's because we look at Benoit, but it's really cool to see Orton crowned. Again, too bad they mess it up the next night. JBL works the leg against The Undertaker for the entire match. It was ill-advised, and the terrible finish doesn't help anything either. Well, what's also kind of funny about Toronto in this aspect is how much they hate Edge. It's his hometown, and he hasn't even cuckolded poor Matt Hardy yet, and they're still booing him. It's a good show. It's an easy show. I think the triple threat for the Intercontinental with Edge and Batista and Jericho's fun. It's just not near the top. Let's deal with the worst show of the year. I think it's Bad Blood, all right? I think this is where you can really see the Chris Benoit experiment starting to fall behind, right? This is where Benoit defends against Kane. Benoit fights La Resistance in the opener with Edge. So he's all over the show, but he's all over the beginning of the show. You also have that terrible main event we talked about before, Triple H and Shawn, 47 minutes. Randy Orton-Shelton is actually a pretty good match. It's a fun match because it's like the continuation of Shelton fighting Triple H and so on and so forth. Women's match is okay with Victoria and Trish versus Lita and Gail Kim, but then you got Jericho against Tomko, which is terrible, and Eugene against Coachman. Eugene and Coachman, man, like, you're not doing Eugene any favors. I have that match at 1 star. I have their Triple H Michaels match at 0.75 stars. It's really not a good showing, and those two matches back-to-back, ugh, like, not, I don't mean back-to-back, like, in time in the show, but just that they're both on the same show doesn't help. Again, I don't know what the obsession is with Coachman, but they wanted him to wrestle. Best show of the year, WrestleMania. I went into it before. I think it's really fun. All-time great show. A close behind, I have SummerSlam, which, again, is fun, and Vengeance is also a decent show. So top five bottom wrestlers of the year. I want to do one with my ranking, and then I want to extend it to the men because it's mostly women. So, top five worst wrestlers of the year. Number five, Lita. Still can't punch. Still can't really have any psychology. Number four, Jackie Gayda. I mean, like, she should be in more, but She's not in the matches enough. She's not enough to really go further. Number three is a man. We'll talk about it in a minute. Number two, Tori Wilson. Number one, Dawn Marie. These people should not be in the ring. This is the argument forever with the women's division. It's like, why are you even having it if you're not going to take it seriously or you're not going to put people that don't completely expose the business in the ring? If we take the women out, number five, worst wrestler of the year, Mark Jindrak. Number four, Jamie Noble. Number three, Scotty Too Hotty, who's just hanging on, right? He's just I think a gimmick change might have helped. You're just hanging on to do that worm, okay? Number two, worst wrestler of the year, Eugene. Again, he's in there with Coachman. He's not in a position to have great matches. And the worst wrestler of the year, Jonathan Coachman. I can't believe he even qualifies. To qualify, you have to do three matches on pay-per-view. He has it. They're all bad. They're all terrible. He's a non-wrestler competing in the wrestling ring constantly. He's in there with Eugene, okay? He's in there with against Tajiri. You know, it's just a mess, right? He's a mess of a participant for the entire year. Five best wrestlers, then we're out of here. Number five, Batista. He's coming into his own, Batista, which I really like. He's part of that Evolution handicap match at WrestleMania. He gets, what I like is he gets to shine, right? Which is something you can't say for a lot of guys. A lot of guys kind of get buried into bad positions. He's in that really cool Survivor Series match where Orton, Jericho, Benoit, and Maven win control of Raw for a month each. He's in the triple threat at SummerSlam. He starts teaming with Flair, and he's pretty good in that team to begin with. He has a pretty fun match with Jericho. So he's got a good year. You know, all in all, a good year. I don't know if he'd make it in a couple of other years, but, you know. Chris Jericho is number four. He's got the match with Christian. He's in that Survivor Series match. He's got the handicap match against Christian and Tristratus. Triple threat with Batista. Match with Benjamin. So Jericho's a guy who's just got like a pretty solid baseline for the year. He's not in any great matches, unless you want to count the Christian one. But he's still good all the same. Number three, Eddie Guerrero. Your mileage may vary on the Bloodfest with JBL. I didn't like them. I found them a bit slow. But he's got the matches with Angle. He's just great. Eddie Guerrero's a great wrestler. Number two, Randy Orton. Match with Benoit at SummerSlam. He's got the match with Cactus Jack. He's another guy. He's got the WrestleMania handicap match. Good baseline. Always fun. Always good. Orton's a guy I've grown to love. I didn't love him from like 07 to 2011. Ever since then, he's one of my favorite guys. And when I look back now, I actually appreciate his work. And number one's Chris Benoit. I'm just going to say he's number one. He's got a bunch of great matches. It's hard to look back, but best wrestler 2004. So, 2004 in the books, 8th worst, 28th best, right? It beat 2003 by 3 points, which is nothing. And it came down to 2004 having a bit better of a mid-card, I think, and a few less all-time shitty matches. Otherwise, 2003 beats it in every other category. I want it to be a bit more upbeat for this year than the last year, but this year's a hard year to talk about. So thanks for bearing with me. Listen, check out all the stuff we got going on the North South Connection Podcast Network. Mondays, you get The Year That Was, drops every 2 weeks, coupled with Montreal to Memphis. Montreal to Memphis is me and Reg talking about, we do deep dives on things, on all kinds of different things. We've done Brock Lesnar in the past and a Randy Savage, and I actually think those shows are quite fun and interesting. So if you haven't given those a chance yet, please do. Check it out. Tuesdays, TNA Never Dies, JT, Jenny, and I, we're going through TNA, NWA TNA from the very beginning. It's a lot of fun. And that's coupled with the Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast, Jacob Williams tearing it up with various partners. Wednesday, Chad Campbell Day, Fighting Spirit of 06, we're going through 06. Carolina Dreaming, which ties into the Place to Be Nation stretch project, greatest WCW match of all time. He'll suggest some matches to you that you might have never heard of, or you've only heard of in terms of lore. Check it out. He's got some great suggestions for you. Thursday, Attitude Era, JT and Chad doing the Monday Night Wars. Warzone. Fuck, I don't know why I thought of it. Monday Night Warzone podcast. Check it out. It's fun. And that's coupled with the ECW Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, John D'Amato, and Jenny going through ECW. And Saturdays, you get No Holds Barred. Sometimes you get Jeff Learns Wrestling. Sometimes you get JT's Trevor Trove. So check it out. North South Connection Podcast Network. You know, any support you can give us, even if it's just sharing our stuff, telling people about it. Want to grow it as much as we can. It's really just about having fun. get in touch with me. I'm at Aaron D. George on Twitter. I love to talk with anybody who wants to talk about these shows. So that's it. The year that was 2004. Next time, we are jumping forward in time. We're going to be doing something very, very recent. And of all the years that I watched through, this was undoubtedly the hardest one to sit through. The most difficult by any stretch. But not the worst year. So check it out. The year that was. Thanks, guys. See you next time.